evening's subject, which has to do with the Gospel of Thomas within the context of the redemption and the Redeemer. As you may recall, last week in our first talk, we reviewed primarily the human condition as stated by Jesus and reported in the Gospel of Thomas, the condition of alienation, of the loss of our original condition, and many more. And now we address ourselves to the issue of redemption. By way of preliminary considerations, we might ask ourselves, as perhaps we shall ask ourselves again at the end of our present discourse, why is this concern with the redemption or salvation present? The issue of salvation, redemption, is one actually that is not very frequently considered or accepted as valid in today's world. People no longer seem to think that they need to be redeemed or saved, and they have serious doubts that they can be saved by anyone. Maybe the latter consideration has more to do with it than any other. Yet it is quite evident that people suffer, people are alienated from reality, people are deprived of love, are lacking in respect for themselves, and are bereft of hope. They experience these things just as much as they did in the days of Buddha and of Jesus, and in view of the increase of the world's population, one can be quite certain that there are many more who experience them than did in those distant times. Perhaps Christianity's insistence on the fact that salvation has already come to pass with Jesus some 2,000 years ago, combined with the continuing misery and torment of the human race, has made us turn away from views of salvation and of saviors in disappointment. The modification of this principle by evangelical Protestant Christians who declare that one is only saved when one somehow personally accepts the Savior and salvation has not particularly improved this situation either. I remember my considerable consternation and perplexity a great many years ago, more years than I care to remember, when I came to this country, and when people would sort of come up to me without any provocation on my part and ask me if I was saved, you know? And I sort of stood there scratching my head, and I didn't know what to say. To the extent that I answered that peculiar, puzzling question at all, I would usually just say, well, I think so, which somehow never seemed to satisfy this category of persons. And of course, I was raised in a tradition where the doctrine was that salvation has occurred already, and that one participated in it in various ways by participating in the sacraments and all that, but some kind of a personal event for oneself in connection with what has happened 2,000 years ago was not part of that picture. Well, of course, I learned differently. So one is bound to admit, of course, that the evangelical Protestant notion of this is somehow this personal event or personally accepted event of salvation is a kind of quasi-Gnostic notion, and it is a recognition to the effect that if salvation is to be effective for the individual, it must be somehow inwardly realized by the individual rather than it being some sort of purely external or even cosmic event. Still, such quasi-Gnostic notions by themselves do not bring gnosis. Otherwise, evangelical Christendom would be filled with gnosis, and there would be gnosis pouring out upon us on Sunday night television, which I very much regret is not the case. If you have not really discerned that yet, then I feel obliged to tell you. You know, it's just really not happening, folks. At least not there. This is what we frequently encounter, that there are sort of individual vignettes, little tiny slices from the great big Gnostic pie, which various people throughout history get hold of, and they extract them, they slice them out, and then they hold them up as something very great and very valuable, which of course indeed they are, but for the most part only within context. Out of context, they usually don't seem to do much. Thereby hangs, let's say, a fairly long and involved tale, as one might elaborate on Shakespeare's statement, "Thereby hangs a tale." This is really an issue very much worth considering, because I predict with my great powers of prophecy, which equal those of the late Mr. Criswell of many years ago, whom some of you may remember. Criswell predicts, you know, we are all interested in the future where you and I will spend the rest of our lives. You know? I predict that that sort of thing will be, that kind of approach, this pie-slicing approach, will be applied increasingly to various Gnostic scriptures now that they are available, and it's all, to a minor extent, it is already being done. And our favorite scripture with which we are dealing here now, the Gospel of Thomas, lends itself to that perhaps even a little better because of these many, many isolated, short, epigrammatic sayings which it contains. And so people always take some part or particle of the gnosis and sort of run with it. Let's say 100 years ago or thereabouts, and ever since then, people got hold of certainly an aspect of the gnosis, which is the recognition of the creative, or as they were wont to call it, causative aspect of the mind, or as we call it, consciousness. And this has led to the entire great flourishing of the 19th century and 20th century so-called New Thought movement, which is all going on in various ways, and which has also very greatly and really in a rather inflated manner reappeared in the so-called New Age under the its present phrasing, far more inflated and arrogant than Mary Baker Eddy or Thomas Troward or any of those people would ever dare to phrase it, namely to create your own reality. Now, you see, there again, when recognized within the a sort of total mandala of the Gnostic worldview, or at least in any kind of worldview that is reasonably close to the Gnostic one, this kind of creativity, this reality creation, and the human as at least a secondary or sub-creator within a larger creation, which is what Tolkien called him, incidentally, makes sense. But when that is totally taken out and put up there, here, create your own reality, you can do anything, it becomes, a kind of a will-o'-the-wisp, and eventually usually leads to disaster. Because that sort of thing, as a rule, goes on for a while, and then one has a great big Humpty Dumpty-like downfall. and all the New Age's horses or the other anatomical parts of those horses cannot put such a person back together again. Look at something else. Let's say the issue of reincarnation, as exploited and inflated by much of 19th century occultism and more recently in our days again, is again a sort of a slice, a sort of a pie out of a very, very large world picture. Reincarnation at best needs to be understood within the context of a larger spiritual situation. Otherwise, it becomes meaningless. So we shouldn't delude ourselves that when a Shirley MacLaine or somebody else all of a sudden gets excited about reincarnation and starts telling you about all their love affairs for the last 25,000 years or something of that sort, that this is some kind of marvelous salvific event that has come to the world and that needs to be celebrated in with circular dances and hammer dulcimers or whatever the case may be, because it really isn't. It's just another sort of thing that the late and redoubtable Madame Blavatsky would have called a flap doodle. Which is a word somewhat like aloha and can be applied to many different things coming and going. So the isolated little pieces of the Gnostic pie do not do any good. They do not fill up the spirit any more as a tiny little piece of pie will fill up one's innards. And so it goes, you know, on and on. Most recently, the Gnostic or quasi-Gnostic ideas of cosmic Christ and of the immanence of the divine in the world and in matter have been taken out of context, first by fairly moderate individuals such as the late Father Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, and then of course along come the popularizers and the sort of intellectual vultures who live off the teachings of others gone by cheapening them, such as for instance Matthew Fox and the numerous flapdoodles playing at so-called creation spirituality and things of that sort. And what they do now, they take these teachings once again out of context advocating a situation that is totally unbalanced. Because while, let us say, in the original context of a real gnosis, whether it be in Hinduism, whether it be in theosophy, whether it be in Gnosticism proper, the immanence of deity in matter and in the cosmos is always balanced by the teaching concerning the transcendence of the same. Or it's probably best summed up in the statement in the Bhagavad Gita by attributed to Sri Krishna, where Krishna speaking in behalf of the highest deity, as in Gnosticism we would say of the universal father, says, having ensouled the universe with a fragment of myself, yet I remain. Now you see, this is the statement of transcendence. Yes, I have put some of myself in there, but don't forget, I'm also outside of it, and almost in a sense, that's where I really am, that's where most of myself is. And so people come along and they pick up, I will not deal with that at this moment, I think I said a few words about it last time, little half epigrams out of the Gospel of Thomas, such as when Christ says, Jesus says, raise the stone and thou shalt find me, cleave the wood and I am there, and behold, this means that that's where Christ is, that's where God is. And one has to be very careful with this sort of thing. Because what really happens is, and we are, let's see, we are seeing now, again, I think, a very pernicious development. It's not the only pernicious development, I assure you. There are legion. But we only have this one evening and only a portion of it, so I can only mention to you one. But we are witnessing a certain pernicious development which is cloaked in very spiritual terms, but which is essentially and truly no more than a new version of the kind of old 18th century and early 19th century pantheism, or in other words, a spiritually cloaked materialism, which says there is nothing but the cosmos is God, matter is God, how wonderful, how great, and there isn't anything else. Now, if that's what all of this new age and all of this flapdoodle is going to lead to, then thank you very much. I think that I was more comfortable with the old nonsense than with that one. And you have to be very careful about it. And the way that it arises is that these teachings are taken out of the larger context which exists in such things as all the variations of the Gnostic systems, the Kabbalah, and many others, the emanational teachings of the Hindus. There you have a complete system. So there are great and evident dangers that come from a kind of ignorant eclecticism, where you pick and choose what appears to suit your purposes at the time and hold them up as the great truth. And of course, when your motivations often are rather shady, such as political, and so forth, advancing some kind of pet project of your own, which you are trying to sanctify with these things, then the whole matter becomes really doomed from the start. Because what you are doing is you are perverting a spiritual or religious teaching or realization to serve lowly ends, and that never works. You might as well go back in time and join one of the less reputable crusades and, you know, butcher a few thousand Saracens or even Christian Greeks in Jerusalem, because that's what that sort of thing amounts to, is the misuse of religious principles for lowly ends. If this world indeed is God, and then if there is no other God, if the cosmos is God and there is no other God above it, then heaven help us. And the problem is, in that case, heaven won't, because it won't be able to. And besides, you know, haven't we heard words very much like these before? Today, the new pantheists make the cosmos utter these words, which, however, we have heard before from someone whom the Gnostics called the Demiurge. I am the only God, and there is no other God before me. So it is thus that a bit of fragmentary gnosis without the Gnostic context becomes a tool of the archons. So we have lost much of our regard in our current culture for salvation, but that does not mean that we are not in need of it. Soteriology, as it is called in Greek, the doctrine of salvation, is an integral part really of any and all religions. In many religions there may not be a singular salvific figure, such as the savior of Christendom. But there is always a doctrine of redemption, of salvation. For instance, in Judaism, which is of course the monotheism paramount, it is quite clearly acknowledged that God is the savior. It's one of his roles. He's creator and judge and all kinds of things, but he's also savior. So when the word occurs in the Old Testament, Job speaks of I know that my Redeemer liveth. You know? So these things are always there. For instance, I have taught for a good many years of my life religious studies, comparative religion in school, and one of my favorite textbooks, which I still have, always has five points, five criteria about any religion, that you have to learn about that religion to know what it really says. The first question that it answers is what and who is the human being. Every religion says something about human nature. The second one, what is the existential plight of the human being? The third is, what is salvation, or how are we redeemed from our plight? The fourth is, what is the desirable conduct that we must adopt? And the fifth, what is our ultimate destiny? So we may say that the issue of salvation or redemption is always there. Without, there is no religion of any kind. There isn't even anything resembling a philosophy of life. Now, turning now to the Gospel of Thomas, we must ask the question, perhaps first of all, what are we being redeemed from, according to the Gospel of Thomas? And most of you are aware, and probably many of you have at one time or the other in your life have gotten, as the contemporary lingo has it, somewhat turned off the issue of redemption, is because you have been told over and over again that what we are redeemed from or of is sin. And among them, all kinds of peculiar notions that we may come back later on, that remote ancestors of ours have been sort of fooling around with certain fruits of trees, that this in turn created a tremendous catastrophe and imposed upon us what they were pleased to call original sin, which sort of messed up everything for good, and that this is what we need to be saved or redeemed from. Now, Gospel of Thomas has its own statements. And while they really belong perhaps in some of them, it overlaps into the category of sayings that I will deal with a week from tonight, namely about self-knowledge. I feel that these reasons, which are stated over and over again, are probably most succinctly and at the same time also most fully stated in the 22nd saying of the Gospel of Thomas, where after an introductory statement dealing with infants who are being nursed and the question as to whether we must become children to enter the kingdom, Jesus says, and here is the saying, when you make the two into one, and when you make the inner like the outer, and the outer like the inner, and the upper like the lower, and when you make male and female into a single one, so that the male will not be male, nor the female be female. When you make eyes in place of an eye, a hand in the place of a hand, a foot in the place of a foot, an image in the place of an image, then will you enter the kingdom. I'm using Mayer's translation. Now, once again, Professor Mayer calls our attention to several sources where cognate passages are to be found. And this is very valuable. In the Gospel of the Egyptians, which is part of Machamadi, we read that Jesus says to Salome, a female disciple, in response to a question very similar to the one asked in the Gospel of Thomas, and he says to Salome as follows, when you have trampled the garment of shame, and when the two become one, and the male with the female is neither male nor female, then will you enter the kingdom. Similarly, in the second letter of Clement, the author Clement says, for when the master himself was asked by someone when his kingdom would come, he said, when the two will be one, and the outer like the inner, and the male with the female, neither male nor female. And yet in another source, in the a non-canonical yet apparently fairly orthodox scriptures called the Martyrdom of Peter, there we read, concerning this the Master says in a mystery, if you do not make what is on the right like what is on the left, and what is on the left like what is on the right, and what is above like what is below, and what is behind like what is before, you will not recognize a kingdom. Now here are three cognate statements from other sources. Now the Gospel of the Egyptians is manifestly a Gnostic Gospel and part of the Nag Hammadi collection, but Clement and the Martyrdom of Peter are orthodox sources, yet they repeat almost verbatim the content of this saying as present in Thomas. Clement, for one, clearly says that the Master said this, thus authenticating the saying with what might be called orthodox authority. That he has an interpretation of the saying, which may not be ours, is true, but he does repeat it, that it has been said. Here we have a serious and perhaps somewhat curious matter. Jesus does not say when your sins are forgiven, or when you have been purified, which would have been sort of the Essene lingo, or when you are no longer in sin, or when you have been saved from original sin, but when you make the two into one, then you will enter the kingdom. The first point to ponder is that he speaks of an internal condition as the prerequisite for entry into the kingdom. We might say that we have an answer to both the question, what are we being redeemed from, and to a certain extent, an answer to the question, how are we redeemed? We need not be redeemed from sin, but from a state of internal disunion. And we are redeemed in turn by bringing this disunion to an end and reunifying our nature. It is interesting to note that not only does Jesus not refer to sin, but he does not refer to the separation of the human from God even. What he speaks of instead is the separation of the human from himself. The 22nd saying thus is in fair measure representative of the entire content of the Gospel of Thomas, or at least of the tone of its entire content. The emphasis is internal rather than external. In fact, the emphasis is what today we could call psychological. There is not only something wrong with you in terms of your existential condition, which is what we spoke about last time, wherein you find yourself, such as your immersion in earthly darkness and in the body of darkness, your alienation from your divine source. These things are true enough, but there is also something wrong in you that must be remedied. And remedied by reunification, by bringing about a wholeness within you. If you don't become whole, you won't enter the kingdom of the Pleroma, as we would call it, says Jesus here. The work of the Demiurge has not only cast you into a heavy, unwieldy body and makes you live in a world of suffering and evil, but it also penetrated inside yourself. It has caused a multiple split within you, which must be healed lest you continue to languish in this world of darkness and not enter the world of light. So several confirming conclusions also offer themselves here. One is that one of the most solemn titles given to Jesus in both in the canonical and in the Gnostic Gospels is the Greek word soter, the precise meaning of which is maker of wholeness, or in its physical application, healer. From this, some rather heletic sort of people drew the erroneous conclusion that the most important thing about Jesus were his physical miracles of healing the body. In my estimation, nothing could be farther from the truth. Still, he was the healer and remains the healer, but in a much more important sense, this being the task of healing a disastrous and all-pervasive interior ailment of the human race. It reminds me in some measure of the famous statement of or the famous incident attributed to Buddha, which I may have mentioned last time, if not I should have, the story of the mustard seed, wherein a woman's child had died of a serpent bite, and she tried to get the Buddha to bring the child back to life. And the Buddha sent her out on a mission to collect the seed from every household where there was no grief, there was no sorrow. So she came back and she didn't have any seeds because there was some grief, some sorrow in every household. And the Buddha said, I cannot bring your child back to life. But today you have learned something, and today the whole world weeps with your sorrow. So in a sense, what you might say, Buddha tried to correct the ailment in her mind, in her soul, with this recognition, which in the long run was probably far better for her and for the enlightenment of the human race than just bringing one person, no matter how precious, back to life. But this hileticism is with us all the time. Remember once I had a dreadful scene after a lecture in Houston, of all places. Well, of course, things happen in Texas, you know. There's just no doubt about it. Who incidentally considered himself a big follower of Manly Hall and all of that, but of course one can consider oneself most anything, as you know, and kept insisting on this idea of the miracles, especially of the healing, and that physical healing is the only test, the only proof of the genuineness of any kind of a spiritual circumstance. The Cathars, our fellow Gnostics in the 13th century and thereabouts, in the Languedoc, in the few remaining scriptures that we have from them, have a little passage about Jesus performing a healing. And they say he never healed the body. He always healed the soul. And from the readjustment, let's say, the healing of the soul then sometimes flowed bodily results. But that is the true healing, starting at the center, starting at the cause, as it were. Well, in any event, certainly the healing element is there, but it is the healing of an interior ailment. So it might be said that Jesus is the soter, the healer, because he can facilitate the healing of the internal divisions, of the fragmentation, of the dismemberment. That is what it's addressed to. Another confirming or at least related circumstance in modern times concerns the work and the teachings of the great modern Gnostic C.G. Jung. As you know, some of us are convinced that both here and in Europe, and there are highly reputable academic authorities among them, such as Giovanni Filoramo, that Jung's psychology in its entirety is really based on Gnosticism, that it is almost a modern psychological adaptation of ancient Gnostic principles. Of course, there are other people who deny that vehemently, like a curious gentleman by the name of Siegel, also connected with some southern university, who recently had sort of plagiarized my title, More Than 10 Years Old, of the Gnostic Jung, you know, and put out a book under that title. But of course, you know, titles are not copyrighted, so that can be done. But that wouldn't bother me so much. And it's published in the Bollingen series, for that matter. But he purports to collect Jung's various essays and portions of different writings in the collected writings that pertain to Gnosticism in that book. But he also writes about an over 70-page introduction in which he says that Jung did not understand Gnosticism and I don't understand Gnosticism. Well, it's at least I'm in good company. If Jung didn't understand it, then I don't mind misunderstanding it the way. If I can misunderstand it the way he misunderstood it, I think we'll be in pretty good shape, both of us. You know? I don't know why I brought that up, except that I'm mildly irritated with that. And one does have to voice one's irritations occasionally. But the truth of the matter is that on this very issue, one can see the tremendous convergence between Jung and Gnosticism. Jung discovered early in life, because let's say his gnosis always had an experimental aspect or basis. He discovered early in life that people are multiple beings, that they contain numerous part cells. And as I often point out, his initial great recognition concerning that came from experiments with spiritualism, with mediumship. Because he saw, particularly with this one young woman who was a relative of his and who went into trances and poured forth all kinds of interesting materials, that she had the sub-personalities which revealed themselves in these trance communications. And that, in fact, the process which went on months and months and months of these trance communications had a kind of underlying keynote of an attempted integration on the part of the psyche of this young woman. So her soul was trying to put itself together, and lacking on other modality, it did so in this trance state. And Jung felt that when it was all over, she sort of became a new person. This was one of his early dramatic confrontations with part selves. He called many of these autonomous complexes later on. Now, he also said that we must be redeemed from this condition of dividedness. In us, there are several part selves. They must unify. The psyche wants to unify itself. It wants to make the two or the several into one. But there are obstacles. The greater the neurosis, the more difficult the unification. Then the neurosis resists the unification. Jung tried to so structure, let's say, his own form of psychoanalysis that it would help to undo these divisions. He wanted to facilitate what he called individuation, which literally means becoming an undivided or indivisible unity, which in Latin is called individuum, not able to be divided. He often said that the human soul cries out for redemption and that it ought to be assisted toward its redemption. So Jung in modern times, let's say, confirms and reaffirms what Christ said in the 22nd saying of Thomas: the divisions must be healed, the splits must be healed. And if that does not happen, then we are really going nowhere, whether we are following Jesus or Muhammad or Carl Jung. And we are going nowhere, least of all, to the kingdom of the fullness, the kingdom of heaven. Now, of course, you might say that this seems all true enough, but how? And moreover, how will such an internal process, such a psychological process, lead to union with God, which is, after all, the only true objective of all mystical endeavors, in fact, of all religion and spirituality that is worth its name? I'll try to address myself to the second of these, namely, there are, as it were, two different divisions to consider. I originally intended to bring with me this evening a kind of rather large brass Egyptian ankh that I have at home, that is so meant as a wall hanging, it's about this big, but I will just have to visualize it, because in my usual alert and dedicated fashion, I forgot it at home. So you all are familiar, because in the 60s and at various times, the ankh crosses became very popular, of what they look like. There is a sort of circular design on top, then there is a horizontal line, and then is a vertical line. Now, in some Gnostic scriptures, particularly in the Bruce Codex, there is in fact a big, elaborate, beautiful sort of diagram picture, which indicates that the circle may be taken as the symbol of the eternal, undivided fullness. That is the pleroma. Then there is a horizontal division which divides the realm of fullness from the kenoma, the realm of relative emptiness, where we are. So that's the horizontal division. So you might say God there emanated or created beings like ourselves down here. But that's not all. Then there is a vertical line. This vertical line shows our condition. So if you look at the vertical line, the handle of the Ankh, where the Pharaoh or whoever would hold it up, you know, although sometimes they dangled it from the top too, you would say that this horizontal line here indicates left, right, good, bad, male, female, old, young, this, that, all the various polarities right over there. So these are the two divisions. On the one hand, we are divided from the above by a horizontal, the horos, the limit, and then we ourselves are split down the middle. Now, you may think that's all sort of flapdoodle symbology and all of that, but it could be very revealing, and I'm really sorry I don't have an ankh in front of me. Because when sort of looking at that image and trying to internalize it for this purpose, it occurred to me that if this were, let's say, a maze of some sort, or a pinball machine, or, you know, one of those games where you're trying to run a little ball or something through certain channels, as long as you are off to the side of that middle column, so to say, you can never get up to the circle. So what you have to do is from there you have to get into the vertical handle of the ankh, and then you can move up there and get into the circle and across the division, the upper division over there. So if we can take that as a sort of symbol of what we are doing, first you have to unify what's on the side and bring it into the middle, and then you can go upwards and successfully. Otherwise, you can't. This seems to be the essence of that 22nd saying of the Gospel of Thomas. It would seem then that the division, let's say, between the human and the divine cannot come to an end, lest the division within the human cease first. Incidentally, another evidence of this is the frequent use in the Gospel of Thomas of the term solitary one, in Greek monachos, from whence the word monk is derived in English. Now, undoubtedly, there are merits of solitariness, but then there are also merits of non-solitariness. Whether we are talking about self-reliance, self-sufficiency, and so forth, but in the context of many of the sayings where monachos occurs, they preclude this interpretation. So it has been suggested that monachos means something like the Latin vir unus, meaning the man who is one, the human who has become one, no doubt having unified the right and the left and the various other dichotomies. So once he was several people, then he became the unified one, the solitary one. So when Jesus says they will do this and that, and then they will become a single one, will be a unified person. The other question, of course, is how is this to be accomplished? We shall answer this in greater detail in the last discourse in this series, but this much we can say right now. The key appears to be self-knowledge, or what Jung called consciousness. This is rather self-evident once we contemplate the matter. How could we even begin to put the part selves of our nature, of our psyche together, lest we know what they are? So the left and the right and the various other dichotomies must be brought into conscious awareness first. First you have to know what is there. How could they even unify otherwise? Once this is done, their reconciliation and their union may follow suit. It is here that Jung was most wise and perceptive indeed when he recognized that alchemy was the grand paradigm of this Gnostic process. So, why? Because in alchemy we have a sort of step-by-step process. whereby it is indicated to us how the divisions are healed, how the opposites come together. In the older Gnostic scriptures, in the Nag Hammadi scriptures and so forth, there is very little of that said, probably because that was procedural matter. Things like that were taught by teacher to pupil, like was true also among the Hermeticists. And so in the Nag Hammadi scriptures, Gnostic scriptures in general, we sort of have the result. We are confronted with the results of Gnosis. And these are people who have experienced union, not only the dualities, but with the divine, and then wrote about it, Valentinus and others. But of the preconditions to that, not such a great deal is said. So that Jung very wisely felt, in alchemy is the missing part. The available Gnostic scriptures indicated the union of the manifest, the human part with the divine. But alchemy shows how to unite the human first. Now, this may also give you a clue why Jung did not speak, at least not in public, of strictly speaking metaphysical and religious matters. I am not Jung. He didn't tell me this, so I have just an intuition and I'm conjecturing. But I think he was convinced that if the alchemical model is followed by the human being, and the human being becomes unified, then the greater union with the divine will ensue. So he didn't have to talk about it. He could merely tell people to address themselves to this, because the results would automatically follow. And of course, being a psychologist, he could much more easily do this than anything else. All of this means that before any of us, any of us can return to the original home, something must happen to us, inside of us. If we want to put it in somewhat simplistic terms, God doesn't want a bunch of neurotics in heaven. Can you guess why? Because they would turn heaven into hell in a rather short time. Turn it into hell. Thanks. True Gnostic statement, sir. True Gnostic statement. They would turn it into hell. Doesn't God love the neurotic? Well, we might say yes, but not enough to desire his troublesome company on a permanent basis. But so the Gospel of Thomas tells us, God and his Logos offer us help in order to overcome the internal, the neurotic dividedness, this internal fragmentation. Help is available, and it is incumbent on us to seek it. We don't have to remain divided creatures, and consequently, we don't have to remain separate ultimately from the fullness, from the light of the divine. So we might say wholeness is a prerequisite for the fullness. Those who are not whole miss the mark, which is the meaning of sin, hemartia, in Greek, and thus cannot enter the kingdom. Sin to the Gnostic reader of the Gospel of Thomas is not someone who breaks Moses' commandments, but someone who is so divided internally that he or she continues to miss the mark. Although, as I say, more shall be said of all this in our last lecture, we might mention a few pointers as to how we may become whole in the sense indicated by these Gospels in a contemporary sense. I think that this may be a fairly useful summary. So perhaps you may want to pay attention. First, don't take the world and life at face value. Subject it to the radical Gnostic analysis. See the flaws, the inconsistencies, acknowledge the suffering, realize that you are living in a mess. If you can't do this, you are hopeless. Take it from me. You might have to reincarnate a few more times or a few more hundred times before you can see and do this. This is the alchemical task of looking at the existing world and allowing it to be destroyed before your eyes, because it's unreal. This is the cutting, the breaking up, the torturing of the cosmos, of the world, of matter, according to the alchemical symbolism. The second, don't yield to the temptation of believing that the world can be fixed. Above all, don't yield to the hubris that you can fix it. Realize that your actions can at best make some conditions in the world a little more bearable, make suffering a little less painful. But just because this is all you can do does not mean that you should not do it. Do it even though it will by no means change the existential evil of the world. Do it even though it you know full well that your actions won't make, quote, a better world. These things are very un-American, but nevertheless, they are true. Do it in the face of all hopelessness, because, and why? Because to help, to be compassionate, is your highest calling. Do it without any expectation of far-reaching or great results. There is one thing that this flawed, dark, hopeless world can teach you, and that is humility. Humility in the face of the momentous heaviness, the stifling, oppressive darkness that surrounds you. If you can't do this, if you won't do this, then once again, you are hopeless. Face the situation a few more times and perhaps you will see. Third, having thus reduced the illusion of the world to a mass of what the alchemists call prima materia, now be on the lookout for the creative opposites. Begin to see the left and the right, the dark and the light, the above and the below, not as eternal antagonists, where one must win out over the other, but as complementary. Jesus said also in the Gospel of Thomas, I quote that from memory, I don't have the number of the saying, the good of this world is not good, and the evil of this world is not evil. They will be resolved ultimately into their beginning. This process involves seeing the opposite point of view. You might not agree with it, but see it and try to apprehend such virtues as it may possess. One of the greatest curses of our era is the all-pervading noisy presence of immoderate and one-sided positions. Everyone lets you know his or her position and is unwilling to consider the merits of other positions. The strident advocacy of positions has replaced the search for truth. Such conditions always bring disaster in their wake, for they preclude any meeting or reconciling of the opposites. Remember, self-righteousness ought to be less important than truth. It is the truth that shall make us free, not self-righteousness masquerading as moral superiority. Therefore, look at the opposites carefully. Consider the merits of positions which are not yours, even if you do not agree with them. Let the opposites emerge and interact. Remember that in all likelihood, truth is neither this position nor that position, but something else, still to be discovered, still to be alchemically compounded in some great invisible retort of the soul. And fourth, if you have done as indicated above, you are now in the process, the alchemical soup, as Jung once called it. So if you always wanted to be in the soup, instead of merely spooning it out, there you are. Right and left, male and female, above and below, are intertwined, interlaced, indistinguishable one from the other. Your self-righteousness is gone. You are no longer right. Maybe you are no longer even male or female, at least exclusively or primarily. And here once again, I know our culture goes this way and that way. The preoccupation of the last number of decades with feminism has produced reactions such as Robert Bly's reveling in a kind of curious and oafish masculinity. Be careful, be careful. Ultimately, you cannot derive your identity from being either female or male, but from something else. Because these also will be resolved into their beginning. And, you know, really think of it. If your biggest distinction is in life, that you are a woman, or your biggest distinction in life is that you are a man, it's not much of a distinction. Because everybody has one or the other of these two distinctions. So, you know, kind of try to figure if you could maybe add a little bit of something else to that. It might just be possible, and it certainly would be desirable. These are, after all, accidents of biology, and really not that much more. Plotinus, who was not a Gnostic, and who now and then even had some nasty things to say about some Gnostics in his time, I'm sure they had some nasty things to say about him, although it did not survive, nevertheless uttered an immortal truth when he defined the journey to God, to the journey to divine union, as the flight of the alone to the alone. And this alone is the unified being, the solitary one, the vir unus, the monachos. We must be alone, namely on the one to go to the alone, the one who goes to the one without the second, the ultimate one. And to bring this about, the Logos has come and spoke words such as those in the Gospel of Thomas. Now, just very, very quickly, does this mean then that we all have to undergo psychoanalysis and that we all have to run off to the Jung Institute or this, that, or the other thing? No, not necessarily. Jung, being a psychologist, could only indicate, really, at a practical level, a psychological path. On the other hand, we also need to recognize, I think, that these statements are not mere psychology. There is a constant resentment on the part of people who come from religious traditions to Jung and other people making, let's say, statements about religious issues. And they say these are psychologisms, they are cheapening mysticism, they are cheapening the flight of the alone, of the alone. Well, I think that that's a very unfortunate way of viewing the situation. Because Jung, I think, put his finger on something that the Gnostics knew, namely that there is a precondition for union with the divine, and it is that coming together of the opposites. Now, another question. Does this mean that we have to wait forever and ever and ever until all that alchemy works with us and then we shall see God? Well, maybe not. I feel, and I think that there is reason for that, to say that in terms of the study of the lives of the great mystics and so forth, that there are possibilities of a kind of temporary vertical unification of the opposites, even as there is the possibility of a temporary union with the divine. So let's say a Saint Teresa or a Saint John of the Cross or a Saint Francis did not need to have been totally internally integrated, individuated beings, but various forces came to play in their lives and in their personalities, which at least for a while put them together, and then they were able to be up there at the throne of God. And I think that while we are not of their kind, in our own way that is also possible for us. There are states of consciousness, there are ecstasies, there are altered states of consciousness, whatever you wish to call it, which accomplish that union temporarily and give us thereby an incredible foretaste of what is to come. But these temporary insights and unions should not take away from us the motivation to continue to address ourselves to our internal unification, but quite to the contrary, they should motivate us in that direction. Now, there are 23 sayings in the Gospel of Thomas, which are all sayings of Jesus about himself and about what he has come to do. I spent so much time on the 22nd saying because I felt that it is the key statement concerning the task, the issue. And the others are really also to fall in line. But there are there are some pitfalls that can arise, and I think they are already evident. Yes, the Gospel of Thomas says a great deal about the internality of this task. And so perhaps Harold Bloom is right when he writes a statement that was even noted on our flyer, nothing mediates the self for the Jesus of the Gospel of Thomas. Everything we seek is already in our presence and not outside ourselves. You need not but knock and enter. True. But at the same time, the figure and the work of the Soter is still tremendously important. I'm not accusing Bloom of taking Jesus out of the Gospel of Thomas, but I'm sure someone will try to do it and will say this is all a do-it-yourself project. But then they will be contradicted by a tremendous number of sayings in the Gospel of Thomas. It's one of those tricky dichotomies. Yes, it must be done within you. Yes, you have to do it. But that doesn't mean that it's only done within you and only you do it. So be careful. The helper, the transformer, the alchemist is necessary for the alchemy. Once again, the alchemical metaphor holds true. There hasn't been any alchemical opus that happened on its own without an alchemist being there, guiding the fire, putting the elements together. And so it's not automatic. You can't take the salvific figure of the Soter out of the picture. And I will just rattle off for a couple of minutes here some of the representative sayings out of those 23 that Jesus says about himself. Tenth saying, Jesus said, I have cast fire upon the world, and look, I am watching it until it blazes. This is the new translation. 16th saying, Jesus said, perhaps people think I have come to impose peace upon the world. They do not know that I have come to impose conflicts upon the earth, fire, sword, war. Here is the alchemist who needs to make the separatio and establish the opposite so that they can interact. 105th saying, whoever knows father and mother will be called the child of a whore. Well, that has various possibilities of interpretation, but one of them being, don't be concerned with where you come from anymore in this world. Don't worry about your family lineage, don't worry about anything. You have a new connection now. Otherwise, you're not moving in the right direction. Many others emphasize the mystery of the Savior, of the salvific figure. 17th saying, Jesus said, I shall give you what no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, and what no hand has touched, what has not arisen in the human heart. What has not arisen in the human heart is probably a key statement. You know, there is something that comes from this source that you would never get entirely on your own. The 52nd saying, his followers said to him, 24 prophets have spoken in Israel and they all spoke of you. He said to them, you have disregarded the living one who is in your presence and have spoken of the dead. Well, don't tell me about prophecies. Don't evaluate me in terms of the past. Look at what is in front of you here. Look what this is. This is the way out of this world. Are you going to use it or are you going to quote scripture? The 24th saying, his followers said, show us the place where you are, for we must seek it. He said to them, whoever has ears, let him hear. There is light within a man of light, and it shines on the whole world. If it does not shine, the world is in darkness. So once again, take advantage of my presence. 59th saying, Jesus said, look upon the living one as long as you live, lest you die and seek to see him and be unable to see him. 108th saying, Jesus said, whoever drinks from my mouth shall ultimately become as I am, and I myself will become he, and the hidden things will be revealed to him. The 82nd saying, whoever is near to me is near to the fire, and whoever is far from me is far from the kingdom. These are the sayings that perhaps for our purposes must suffice. So what conclusions do we draw from this? First of all, that there is a task, and that this task is that the human being has to be reunified. An essential change has to occur within this human being before it can go back to the source. And that apparently the main characteristics of that change is a reconciliation, a unification of divisions that exist within the human being. And that in this he receives a great deal of help, and that that help is unique, that help is tremendously powerful. It is both verbal and exhortative in the sense of showing the people what they have to do. And as we will talk about it later on, it is also sacramental, and mysterious, and really in the nature of a mystery, which the rationalistic mind that has been developing sort of since the 18th century does not want to acknowledge, but which certainly every tradition and every culture has always acknowledged. It's so, how should I put it, I understand why it is happening, but it is so, it's still so paradoxical that people will look upon the mysteries, the sacraments, which go back to Christ in Christendom as some kind of nonsensical Catholic corruption or something of that sort. But they will go to the Tibetan lamas and elsewhere and there get empowerments. Right? Mm-hmm. In other words, here we don't believe in the power. But every guru who hits you over the head with a consecrated squash on the end of a stick or something like that, that is power. Oh, I felt the power. Oh, my God. Oh, jeez, you know, and all of that. Now, look, folks, you know, either there is power that can help you or there isn't. And if you are so prejudiced, just because I don't know, your mother or your father was an evangelical Christian or something like else, and or you some preacher traumatized you or something like that, the issue is to get over your prejudice. A prejudice against your own tradition is still a prejudice. And if you don't get over it, then you are one of these divided beings who cannot enter the kingdom. No matter how many times the gurus will hit you with the legendary and apocryphal sacred squash. You need to keep that in mind. But now then, in conclusion, what is, you know, why, it's still a mystery, as indeed the figure of the Redeemer is the great mystery. And I was going to read that other statement, I'll read it another time. When all the disciples give their story of what they think who Jesus is, and Thomas goes up to him and says, Master, I will in no way say who you are. And then Jesus says, you are the one who knows. He says, you are the one who have become drunk from the bubbling spring of that I have measured out. And then he whispers three words to him which remain secret. It's the mystery. And this whole business of redemption is a mystery too. There is the We have all been presented, and we have all been grabbed in some fashion, as primitive and as weird as it is, we have been grabbed at some point by that story of the garden, of Genesis, and that something went wrong, and then we have been driven out of that, and we've been wandering the face of this earth in search of that garden, and that somehow some redemption will come about and we'll go back to the garden again. And that's in the back of our minds. And it's an archetype. It may have no literal truth whatsoever, but there is some kind of mysterious, probably pre-cosmic, even pre-creational truth in it. And we are looking for the garden. But I venture to suggest that the garden is not going to be here on earth. Certainly the garden of nature as it exists now is not that kind of a garden. Here again, be careful. Certain things are in jeopardy. There are elements of the natural world that are in need of being kept from disappearance or from serious impairment. But once again, these are realistic tasks. Realistic tasks have to be addressed realistically. But we have a bunch of people in this world, especially in this country, who probably because of their overwhelming natural sloth, which is the natural condition of the human being, we are all, our natural condition is utter laziness. If you are different from that, there's something wrong with you. You understand that? You're hyper. Maybe you are taking cocaine. Maybe you're manufacturing some kind of amphetamine within you. But you're not really naturally and joyously lazy. There's something wrong. That's the natural condition. And so we want to motivate ourselves to do things, whatever it is. You know, the greatest motivation is to go to the refrigerator and open it up and eat. You know, you overcome your sloth, you get out of bed, you shake the sleep out because over there is something, you know, big pitcher of milk, good, 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 or whatever, you know, different things that you grab, motivation. And so people try to motivate themselves now to kind of undo some of the excesses of the human race. But in order to do that, they dream up vast and unrealistic fantasies and mythologies. And the problem is, if they do that, these mythologies are going to fail them. All this Gaia, all this earth-centered quasi-spirituality, all of this fantasizing about the glories and wonders of earth and of the nature is going to fail. How is it going to fail? That sooner or later you are not going to read books, but look at the darn thing right there, and you see how horrible it is. And you see, what is this? Let me show you a little thing here. Now, I'm a great reader of vampire literature and things like that, because, you know, this world isn't horrible enough without one has to add vampires to it. It's Gnostic optimism. Anne Rice, who is really a fairly fine writer, at least of some of her books, in her latest books in the vampire trilogy, now it's quadrilogy, chronicles really they are, she has a little portion where, quite aside from the story, she describes the rainforest of South America. Now, again, I don't say that, quote, the rainforest shouldn't be saved, because we need it for the climate and all kinds of things, but just listen to this for a minute. The rainforests of South America, great deep tangle of woods and jungle that covers miles upon miles of the continent, blanketing mountain slopes and crowding into deep valleys and breaking only for broad glittering rivers and shimmering lakes, soft and verdant and lush and seemingly harmless when seen through the drifting clouds from high above. The darkness is impenetrable when one stands upon the soft, moist ground. The trees are so high, there is no heaven above them. That already is terrifying. Indeed, creation is nothing but struggle and menace amid these deep, moist shadows. It is the final triumph of the savage garden in Capitol. And not all the scientists and civilization will ever classify every species of painted butterfly or speckled cat or flesh-eating fish or giant coiling snake which thrives in this place. Birds with feathers the color of the summer sky or the burning sun streak through the wet branches. Monkeys scream as they reach out with their tiny clever little hands for vines as thick as hemp rope. Sleek and sinister mammals of a thousand shapes and sizes crawl in remorseless search of one another over monstrous roots and half-buried tubers on the giant rustling leaves and up the twisted trunks of saplings dying in the fetid darkness even as they suck their last nourishment from the reeking soil. Mindless and endlessly vigorous is the cycle of hunger and satiation, of violent and painful death. Reptiles with eyes as hard and shining as opals feast eternally upon the writhing universe of stiff and crackling insects, as they have since the days when no warm-blooded creature ever walked the earth. And the insects, winged, fanged, pumped with deadly venom, and dazzling in their hideousness and ghastly beauty, and beyond all cunning, ultimately feast upon all. There is no mercy in this forest. No mercy, no justice, no worshipful appreciation of beauty, no soft cry of joy at the beauty of the falling rain. Even the sagacious little monkey is a moral idiot at heart. That is, there was no such thing until the coming of man. Well, this is it, the savage garden. And I cannot see how that savage garden could ever become, on this earth, under these circumstances, the garden of paradise. Neither do I really feel that it ever has been. I know the way original sin was interpreted, and was very much the way the eco-fascists are interpreting our sins now. It is always our fault, you know. But how could it have been our fault that going back to the amoeba already, everything eats everything else, and that it goes on from there? It wasn't our fault then, it isn't our fault now. It is just a fault. And so the archetypal garden, the garden of Eden, the restored wholeness, is somewhere else. At best, creation can, in certain of its aspects, point toward the creator beyond all creators, the true source of life, the true source of being. Everything points beyond itself. As Goethe has put it, all things transitory, but as symbols are meant. And if that is understood, then the savage garden itself may present a ladder of the sages, a stairway to heaven, like the stairway that the patriarch Jacob is said to have seen when he put his head down on the rock and slept, and he saw the stairway upon which the angels ascended and descended. But in order to do that, one has to have one's eyes lifted to the everlasting hills above and beyond this world, and not gravel like a blind mole in this world, but face the tasks of the world realistically and with little hope, and put one's hope where it belongs, into redemption, into transcendence, into the divine, into the reality beyond this world. Thank you.